which is the nationally normed test. So we're going to do those, as you say, 4th, 5th, 7th, and 9th. It's my understanding that under the current system, what we were going to do is to simply augment the Terra Nova to make them compliant with NZLB. So I have two questions. Why would we throw out what we've done or change what we've done up to today in order to gain that small amount to have it under one umbrella, as I see it, and not just continue on to augment the Terra Nova with our own questions? I guess that's the way to say it. Do we have under the new system a way to compare Alaska's children with the rest of America's children? Are we moving away from that? Those are two questions.
I'll take the second part of your question first. We are not moving away from nationally normed testing. It is a separate competitive bid process. It is also typically in relationship a very low cost item because it's off the shelf. We're not moving away from it. We understand there's tremendous value in making sure that Alaska students are keeping up and or exceeding those that are happening around the country.
So would it be safe for me to then say that that's a secondary issue in regard to the change from where we are today to the new RFP?
I believe it is a secondary issue, yes.
And that probably answers both questions.
Yeah. Senator Guess.
Thank you. Just follow up on Senator Wilkins' question. So that means that in grades 4, 5, 7, and 9, these students will be tested twice. They'll be tested once against the Alaska standards, and they're going to be tested once against peers. No?
Not necessarily. What the competitive bid process does call for is a benchmark test at all grade levels 3 through 9. We don't have benchmarks in all of those levels now. This is ideally what past educators, past state board members have wanted. It just has not been affordable, and that affordability probably comes in the nature of the competitive market. So to answer your question, Senator, it has not been determined yet. The technical review committee will come together on determining which grade levels and frequency for nationally normed testing would be. There are some critical areas to hit there, but it might, for example, be grades 4 and 7.
But for those areas, I'm sure, for those grade levels, if I may, Mr. Chairman, for those grade levels, they'll just be taking two tests in that year. They'll be taking a benchmark test, and they'll be taking a nationally normed test.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Two more questions, one about timing and one about cost. I don't understand the issue about turnaround time. I mean, I understand turnaround, but we give the test in February. It said on one of the slides, if we gave the test in February of every year, why would that be different than giving it in March or April every year, or October for that matter? We're not testing what the student learned from the first day of September until February. We're testing what he learned or she learned from kindergarten up to whenever. So what difference does it make, as long as you keep it consistent, what difference does it make when you take the test? Why would we throw out the existing system in order to come up with a different testing date?
I have less respond, and I know the direction he's going to go on this is the need for us to have benchmarks aligned with Alaska standards, as opposed to do a benchmark at third grade, then move to a national, regardless of when we test.
The requirement under No Child Left Behind is not only do we have the standards that we currently have in the we have content standards, then we have performance standards for age spans. For example, there's a set for students at age 16 to 18, how much they need to know. No Child Left Behind requires we have grade level expectations, so standards by grade level. The design under this competitive bid is to be able to test those things that are taught in that year, because that's what we want to design a test. It's a compliant test with No Child Left Behind. Also helps us determine what students know based on Alaska standards, and so we would design an assessment that meets those grade level expectations, so that schools, parents, teachers, students know that if you teach and if you learn what is in those grade level expectations for that year, you ought to be successful on the benchmark test for that year. And so it's a greater alignment to testing within the year based on what is supposed to be taught in that year. To do that successfully, pushing back the time that we test 6 weeks will have a significant impact in the amount of instructional time that you can gain and actually teach what is in those grade level expectations. So if we were testing based on what is a nationally normed test from year to year, that would be of less impact the time of the year that you test. But if you're testing based on what are the expectations from the standards for that year, each year, then it's important to move that testing date back so that you maximize the instructional time in the year. Much more significant in a test based on standards versus a nationally normed test to have a later test window.
So in layman's language, that test that occurs in that year is a test from September 1st to February 1st or April 1st?
Yes. You would also learn how did the student do from the previous year to the next year based on how they how their performance
from the prior grade. Okay. All right. And my last couple of questions regarding cost. My research shows me that we're paying McGraw-Hill a little over $4 million this year. We paid $18 million in 5 years, so that's $3.5 million a year, $3.75 million. But on the last slide, Professor, you said that we were upwards of 7 and heading to 9. Did I not do very good research, or where would the $4 million come? Where would the $4 million come from, and why would we escalate up from where we have been over the last 5 years to where you suggest we may be?
Senator, I think your math is fine. Your research is fine. This depicts 05, which is next year. The reason for the dramatic move up is this year we're doing minimal amount. We're not doing the additional field testing, the additional augmentation at this point, the additional forms of the exit exam, the additional forms of the benchmarks. In order to come into compliance, we're going to have to do those things. That is the price that CT McGraw-Hill has given us to make those things happen.
The 798389?
Yes, sir.
Is McGraw-Hill CTB one of the five respondents?
They are.
At the $5 million level?
I will share what I can. I don't know if I can say this. They chose not to bid on all segments of the competitive process, only on certain ones. The ones that they did submit a proposal, they were responsive.
Mr. Chairman, I think that ends my questions. I remain, and this is Commissioner Sampson's baby, and God knows there's been enough time in this legislature since I've been around. Lots of folks, not particularly me, have worked on this. Lots of folks in Fairbanks have worked on it. Our school board has been particularly interested in and participatory in the whole process. But if I had to summarize my concerns, they are, we spent a lot of time and money to get to where we are. I don't think that people understand the reason for change. I would just hope that when we look back on this, that what you are doing, Commissioner, is in the best interest of holding students, teachers, administrators, parents accountable. And for that, I'll just wish you Godspeed. But I'm concerned, and when good people talk to me from across the state that have some I don't know from Adam that have many of the same concerns, I think that you need to go forth with that burden that this should best be the right thing. Because I really don't want to sit here, and I don't want people that follow me to sit here to go back and have to repair what we have done in what amounts to perhaps a fast track. I understand that we, to our credit, ours being this legislature and this, and this administration, the prior administration, got ahead of things. And perhaps if we would have started after we got NCLB, we wouldn't have done some of these things. But we were ahead of the curve, and that's to all of our credits. I appreciate your indulgence and your answers both. And Mr. Chairman, thank you for your indulgence in letting me ask those questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one of the things that I'm very confident in is that this competitive bid, as it unfolds, it won't be constant. Certainly, I hope that it produces benefits for all of the children of Alaska, but I know it won't be constant. It is a constant form of change, the assessment process. So no matter what system, current or other, there's constant change, and we can see it already on the horizon. So it won't be stagnant no matter how good it is.
Senator Green.
Yeah, and that was sort of the question I was going to ask, because I recall in the original conversation about developing the test and the actual test and how it is a never-ending change. I mean, you drop a question, add a question, change the update, modernize, and do all sorts of other things as time goes on, because otherwise we'd have the same test that I had, you know, in 1950, going through some of these, and it's not going to happen. And it does increase. But had you not done anything, would there have been significant changes from, say, the test 2 years ago to the test given next year?
Senator, are you referring to all the tests or just the exit exam?
The assessments. Would all assessments have changed somewhat within their text?
Yes, ma'am. All assessments would have had to have changed to some degree in order to even move towards compliance.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner, with the success of your contractor, what will be the turnaround time that you'll have for them to get test results back to the teachers?
With the proposal review that we have had, a number of the responsive proposals have indicated anywhere from a 2-week turnaround to a 4-week turnaround. They prioritize them, but 2 to 4 weeks appears to be. In some cases, that could be within a week.
Yeah, and as I remember prior conversations, that's as opposed to 4+ months in the existing system track we're on?
Current system is 2 to 4 months.
Thank you. Any other questions? I, too, thank you and your staff for doing this. Very helpful.
Can I just jump on that?
Sure.
One of the reasons is the contractor, but the other reason is that we have a different test. The test today, you have to write things out. Okay, so it's a different look at how you test kids, and that has an effect on the timing.
Senator,
two things happening at one time, isn't there?
We the test window I just referred to with the potential of the new proposal includes the same type of responses we're currently testing.
Constructive so there's
response.
A narrative?
Yes, sir.
Oh, there is? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And thanks for the folks that testified online.
Thank you.
Senator Seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to testify. You want me to wait a minute or proceed?
Are we ready? You okay? All right, go.
House Bill 260, short form known as the Voluntary Healthcare Provider Immunity Act, is an attempt to encourage healthcare workers and providers to volunteer services to Alaskan residents who would otherwise not be able to afford proper healthcare. The bill encourages volunteerism by providing immunity from liability for civil damages, quote, resulting from an act or omission in providing the health care services, end quote, for health care services that are provided free of charge. Now, the Act does not provide immunity from civil damages resulting from gross negligence, recklessness, or intentional misconduct. Moreover, consumers are protected by the requirement that providers must still act within the scope of their current license, must provide services at an appropriate facility, and provide advance written notice of immunity and obtain informed consent in writing. This act is consistent with the Volunteer Protection Act that was passed in Congress in 1997, and 43 other states have followed with similar type legislation. This act is supported, this bill is supported by Alaska Physicians, Covenant House, Alaska Nurses Association, AARP, Naturopathic Physicians, the State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and many others. And you have letters provided in your packet from many of those. All providers in this act are licensed under the Division of Occupational Licensing. All providers in this that are covered here are regulated by boards except dental hygienists and naturopaths, and the dental hygienists are regulated under the Board of Dental Examiners, and naturopaths must prove a four-year naturopathic education at college, as well as must pass the National Naturopathic Physicians Licensing Examination. And nurse wives are covered as advanced nurse practitioners, and they're regulated by the Board of Nursing. And so I would be pleased to answer any questions you have on the bill.
I believe you were here for Representative Seaton's when we heard from Patricia Center.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, and she asked if we should add to Section 3, that's on page 2, 0965-290, Section 3, add this temporary emergency facility. Have you had time enough to think about that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We thought that that was covered under 0965-090, Section A, but there is some clarity that might not be covered there. That's where a person at a hospital or any other location who renders emergency care or emergency counseling to an injured, ill, or emotionally distraught person, that they are immune as well. But if it would clarify the bill in the eyes of the committee, I'm fine with adding that section for emergency facilities.
Yeah, where are you looking? Is that line 12?
It's not in this bill. It's covered in another section for the for civil liability for emergency aid. And she addressed that, and that's where we had considered that those temporary facilities were. It's unclear from her testimony that would cover all situations. So
the section you're quoting there, sir, is that Good Samaritan stuff?
Yes. Yeah. And so I am fully open for the committee adding the emergency temporary facilities.
Yes. So as I remember, her point was that this is not exactly that, because the Good Samaritan is when you stop alongside of the road or whatever, and this is a temporary emergency facility that's set up at the scene of an emergency.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman, there is no intent to exclude those kind of activities, so I have no problems there.
Do you have staff here?
Yes, I do.
You might want to have them think about language that we might add, you know, that you'd be comfortable with if you are. But do you have a question, Senator Guest?
On that point, you also might consider just saying temporary medical facility. I don't know if we have a statutory definition of emergency or not. Would it just kind of unclutter that and get to really, when you have a temporary facility, you're able to do this?
All right. Questions for Representative C?
Yes.
Yes. Senator Green.
Can you explain to me, does this act bring Alaska under the Volunteer Protection Act, as passed by Congress, are, that we became a named participant, or why do we have to do anything if they've passed that act in Congress?
Well, it's consistent with the provisions of the Voluntary Protection Act, but suits can be brought, civil liability can be brought in state court as well as federal. And so 43 other states have followed suit with this type of legislation.
Is there a reference in, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, if I could continue?
Sure.
Is there a reference in this legislation that you have to the, is there's no cite of the federal? Okay. Because it's actually very different. I mean, it's indigent and doesn't, I don't think it's the scope you're talking. Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Senator Guess.
Thank you. Representative Seaton, and I do appreciate this bill. I do have, I'm a little torn only because it's, you know, it's limiting someone's rights so we can offer them health care, basically. And so it's kind of a bigger issue, especially in my district that I struggle with. But I appreciate where you're trying to get. Under the findings, and I was just wondering because it's nowhere in the backup, on page 2, lines 4 through 10, we talked a lot about, you know, what this will do in other states. Is there any proof that actually people have increased access to health care that this actually, I mean, we get a lot, especially with tort reform, which I don't comment really down on one side or the other, the it will do this. Do we have anything that actually says that any of this stuff has happened in the other 43 states?
If I might, Cameron, do we have any any data on increased volunteer?
For the record, Cameron Yurkowski, staff to Representative Seaton. No, we don't have any data from any of the effects of similar bills in other states. We've just heard from the medical professionals that there are people waiting to utilize this bill and volunteer their service.
Thank you. May I just have a few more? Can you speak to me a little bit, not being an attorney, and I know this is going to go to judiciary, so I don't want to go down this line, but can I just understand what is still liable and is incompetence, basically medical incompetence, still included in what's liable versus excluded?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, the provisions in here are that you must be operating within the scope of your current license. So one must always remember that this isn't that someone can go operate outside the scope of their license. So the definition of gross incompetence, I guess it occurs about 50 places in the statutes.
Gross negligence.
As it is really not defined, it's left up to the courts to consider on a case-by-case basis. And so the whole thrust of this is to take it out of an act of omission for simple negligence. Gross negligence, I mean, somebody can always sue, and if the court determines that there's gross negligence, the person is liable. The reason in, on the House side, we added the language about informed consent was that we have it so that anybody that comes into a clinic or any other place they're receiving the free medical services must sign that they understand that they are, you know, receiving this from a healthcare professional who will not be liable for not doing enough tests, you know, and those kind of things, which are the normal kind of suits that are experienced.
So, and this will, but, and I'll let judiciary handle this, but there is still some liability in here for people that are just incompetent.
Through the chair, yes. And also, nothing in this bill exempts the facility itself. So if there is a clinic that is offering services, the clinic must have its liability. It has oversight duties on the people that it has serving with them as well. So that a liability is still.
Thank you. On page 2 on 29, advance written notice, is there a standard definition of that? And I guess I bring up issues of language barriers and illiteracy. Is that something standard in what that means?
I haven't had that exact conversation. If you
Senator, just to the chair, I do have statute where they speak to what the standards are for advance
written notice. Yeah. Okay.
Isn't it like a placard on the counter or something, or a sheet of paper that you see?
Through the chair, you must sign a basically an acknowledgement, and the physician will have that, or the nurse.
Thank you. And if you wouldn't mind, can you give me a copy of that just so I can. Good thing to learn about. And just last question, and I know this is going to sound odd, but what if someone has health insurance or has the means and doesn't necessarily want to receive free health care, but the health provider providing it to them is not being paid? And I know this sounds odd, but you do have communities where that's just the closest place. I mean, the Mountain View Clinic is right there, and it's wonderful and provides good access. And if there's a doc working there who isn't being paid, but someone has, you know, maybe veterans benefits and has some insurance or has a means to pay, what happens in those situations? Because this seems to say, well, the doctor's not liable if they're not being paid, but what if the patient? I know it sounds odd, but maybe through that muddle.
Still pay the clinic.
Still pay the clinic, but the liability is still
with the clinic.
Yeah, through the chair, this bill doesn't address, you know, people any needs base. This is just simply addressing the doctor or the nurse that is providing free care. If someone has means that goes to a free clinic, I mean, this bill doesn't address whether people that have means of support should be excluded from going to a free clinic. It says that if you go to a free clinic, I presume that the clinic is going to look at who they serve and look at their means. Lots of times they may only take people that either are indigent in a village or some other place that doesn't have those kind of things. But there's nothing in this bill that says that someone has to come in and prove to the nurse or the doctor, healthcare professionals providing that free service, that they have not the means to pay.
My apologies for being unclear, and actually, at least in my district, the clinics aren't free or not. There's a variety, and sometimes having people that do have insurance helps provide the facility for those that don't have means. I guess if I walk into a clinic and I give them my insurance cards or my VA card, and I sit down and I see a doctor, and something happens, that where I think I've been wronged, and I go to court and they say, well, this doctor was exempted because they volunteered their services. And I say, well, but I gave him my insurance card. I didn't ask for voluntary services. That's just the situation I wanted to clarify.
Thank you. And through the chair, I think that we've covered that under the written waiver. In other words, the person has to receive written notice before they receive the health care that they're going to be receiving free health care from somebody who will not be liable. And they're going to have to sign that form.
Therefore, I have the choice to say, no, I want someone who's not, and hopefully there's someone around.
Yeah, that's
okay. I'll stop. I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Green.
Are there any examples of like other industry folks or professions where someone is no longer liable for the services they're licensed to give just because they're not being paid? Besides medical? They're like a pilot. Trying to think of someone's license where there's a risk.
Me and Paul.
Yeah.
Oh, that's dangerous.
Through the chair, I would say that there have been several immunity bills that have been passed where people that are operating within a pilot's license, if they're taking people for not for pay, that they were immune from certain liabilities that we just considered this last session. But as far as, I mean, I don't think we've got plumbers that are, maybe there are, but mostly those things that I'm aware of are not volunteer services offered by those licensed professionals that I know.
And I have another question, Mr. Chairman, if I may. On the third page, line 4, and it talks about a health care provider. This section does not preclude a health care provider from be receiving payment or being reimbursed for expenses, including travel and room and board, while providing voluntary services. That's really ambiguous. I'm wondering if that's tight enough for it to really be volunteer service.
Well, through the chair, Ledge Legal thought it was. And what we're trying to provide there is we have a lot of people that go out to the villages. You get a village clinic where you are either have to pay expenses and travel and staying at, you know, a village if you flew out a doctor, flew out nurses in a clinic. And this, other than this being in here, it would mean that you would have to have those people basically pay all their expenses to get out to the clinic to provide the service. So that was the intent of this portion here, was to allow those travel expenses to be reimbursed.
Mr. Chair,
I still suggest it's very ambiguous.
I would actually agree with Senator Green and just respectfully suggest you think about excluding expenses, comma, including maybe in a future draft, so it's for travel and room and board while providing.
Because it says a healthcare provider from receiving payment.
Or
being reimbursed
or
for
being
expenses.
Reimbursed. Yeah,
so it gets, I don't know, I think it's a little broad, because I think the person who's going out to the remote clinic is probably going to a native healthcare facility, which is a totally different government or native corporation. So, which is a kind of a different thing, I think, than what we're trying to address here. So I just want to be sure we have that language tight enough that it does what you want to do, but yet doesn't allow that to be.
It does seem like there's a contradictory between without pay and receiving a payment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? We have two people that would like to testify. Yeah, thank you. Please stick around. I think some more things will come up. Kara Nyquist. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and good afternoon, Chairman Dyson, members of the committee. My name is Kara Nyquist. I am Director of Advocacy at Covenant House Alaska. I'm also a licensed attorney in the state of Alaska.
Well, excuse me, a licensed what?
Attorney. I'm here today.
Your license is current?
It is.
And you're doing this on a volunteer or payment? Never mind.
I do pro bono services for youth for Covenant House. And I also am the legislative chair for the Alaska Association of Homes for Children. So today I'm here to represent not only Covenant House, but also the association. The association is made up of 20 different social service providers throughout the state of Alaska. Collectively, we provide a continuum of care for homeless and at-risk youth and children and youth in need of mental health services. I'm here to support House Bill 260. We support this bill because we currently, several of the agencies, including Covenant House, are already providing free healthcare services to homeless youth, which are obviously low-income youth as well. We currently have a full-time nurse practitioner that stays busy 5 days a week providing services to youth. We have had requests in the past from volunteers that would like to provide service to us and our youth, and they have been prevented from doing so because they have concern of medical malpractice. A particular example is last year we had a military doctor who wanted to provide service at Covenant House, Alaska, but her malpractice insurance did not cover civilian care. At Covenant House, Alaska, we provide services 24 hours a day for homeless youth in our crisis center. We also provide health care on a walk-in basis to youth that come in the clinic that need assistance, and we have two transitional living programs where we provide free health care to youth in transitional living. We believe that this bill will help encourage more people to volunteer, not only nurse practitioners, but the bill also covers chiropractic care, ophthalmologists, dental assistants, and dentists. We find that this bill is necessary because it will help protect the health, safety, and welfare of other citizens and our clients. Our clients often are transient individuals. They are in need of medical care, usually immediate care. They're not clients who are likely to be given an appointment and actually show up for that appointment at a clinic. If we have volunteers on site that can provide immediate care to our clients, they're more likely to take advantage of the service. Our clients have communicable diseases, STDs, and we're able to provide service to these clients to minimize the risk to others. We are also finding that there's an increase in the request for our services at our free clinic and at emergency rooms in town. There are several family practitioners in town that do not accept Medicare or Medicaid, so even if our clients do have some medical insurance, they have difficulty finding family practitioners that will provide service to them. And although there are several first care type of clinics in town where people can visit on a drop-in basis, those clinics are often full now with middle-class citizens, and we're finding that there is an increase in requests in our services and that the volunteers will help us provide more service to those in need. I also wanted to comment, as an attorney, I feel comfortable with the language of the bill. Frequently, we are all asked as citizens to waive our rights to different services we receive, whether it be a pilot's ride or some other service, and often the waiver is much more over-inclusive than what is requested in the bill. The bill simply says that they're not liable, but they are liable for gross negligence or any intentional misconduct. Often when we sign waivers for other services, we do waive our rights to gross negligence and intentional misconduct of the carrier of the service. And this bill does not request such broad limitation of liability. Those are all my comments, Chairman. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions for Carol? Thank you for the service to our kids.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chip Wagner, and I also represent the Alaska Association of Homes for Children. They're one of my clients. And as Kara said, they have endorsed this bill at their spring meeting. Also, another organization I represent, the Alaska Catholic Conference, met last week, and we discussed this bill, and they also support this bill. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Anyone else that would like to testify on this bill?
Another quick question, please.
Paul? Senator Guest?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My apologies, I missed one of my questions. Mental health is covered. I see psychologists. I didn't see psychiatrists or that. I just want to make sure that in general, mental health services, and I'm looking to the people that just said to just spoke on support, are also are covered in here, or as important as services we provide. They are. Yeah. Okay.
And as physicians, I would, Mr. Chairman, if I could, also, in the federal statute, the volunteer statute, they define the compensation. First of all, the term volunteer means an individual performing services for a nonprofit organization or a governmental entity who does not receive a compensation other than reasonable reimbursement or allowance for expenses actually incurred. So, with is yeah, that since the kind of thing that you're...
Well, let them know if you don't have a reference to it.
Yeah, if it's not referenced into here.
Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering, is that the language like that would be acceptable?
I would look to Senator Green.
I'd be happy to look it over and see. Okay, thanks. Yeah. I'll have attorneys look it over.
Back to the question about psychiatrists. Psychiatrists are a licensed doctor, so my guess is that they're covered here under physician.
But they're not defined in healthcare provider in the back and the last page, are they? Or did I miss them somewhere?
No.
They are.
But
okay.
They are a licensed physician.
Oh, physician. Thank you. Thank you very much. I missed that. I appreciate that.
Yeah. All right. I have a couple of amendments that are housekeeping. On page 1, line 7, delete 2003, insert 2004. And page 3, line 20,
immediate effective date.
Delete July 1, 2003, and insert immediately under AS01.070 parens small Arabic C. So I move those amendments.
It's just one.
And
you just want to have that in the form of amendment number one. Those two changes?
Yes. Yes. Is there objection? All right. Seeing none, amendment one passes. All right. I would like to on page 2, line 20. After nonprofit facility, insert the words temporary emergency site. So it go between nonprofit facility and or facility owned by a municipality. So I will move that amendment. Is that all right with you, Representative Seaton?
Yes, it is.
Is there objection?
No. Are you confident that we have a definition somewhere of emergency?
I think that's a problem.
You think that's a problem?
I would say it's a problem. Because would it always be an emergency? That's all.
Yeah. But I will trust you, Representative Seaton, before you get to judiciary to deal with that. If there is a good definition, but if there's not, we'd hate to get to the situation where someone says, well, it wasn't an emergency facility. It was a temporary facility.
Do either of you have language or that you would prefer to insert in this line 4 on page 3?
Not now. I'll have to look at it.
Do you want to delay passing this bill out, or do you want to let them deal with that in judiciary?
Judiciary.
Look to the majority.
I don't care. I just think it needs to be talked about, needs to be handled.
Yeah. if the representative's going to handle it, then I'll address it.
Chairman, I will work with Ms. Tanner about the, that in LAA to clarify.
All right. Any other questions? Amendments?
Your amendment's still on the floor.
Which one was that?
The temporary facility.
All right. Is there objections to amendment number 2, insertion of the words temporary emergency site on line 20, page 2? Seeing and hearing none, amendment 2 passes. What's the wish of the body?
Move to report House Bill 260 for committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, House Bill 260 passes, as amended, passes out of Senate House Committee. Good work, Representative Seaton. We will now take up the CS for Senate Bill 217. I believe the one before us is the D version.
Not yet. We need to move that right off the bat.
Yeah, I would like a motion to have our work draft to be the D version.
So moved, Mr. Chairman. Working draft D, lock put, is our working document.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, we have the D version as our working document. Dr. Olson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Certainly a privilege to be sitting here in front of your distinguished committee. Actually, it's because of the great respect I have for your colleague that I will take that as a compliment. In spite of my personal feelings about this particular issue, partly because we are dealing with a very complicated and something that is going to have an effect on us as we get ready to go into the 21st century with the advances that are happening in medicine and some of the information that's going to be used. If I could continue, Mr. Chairman, the reason I introduced this presentation is to get a handle on this very complicated issue related to genetic privacy. We're all familiar with how useful DNA identification has been for law enforcement and paternity disputes. But there is another side to this new technology that is of special need and is showing itself in each and every one of us in a way that we need to make sure that we have some type of genetic privacy protection here within the state of Alaska. In 2000, a public consortium and a private company announced that they had a working draft of the human genome, spelling out over 3 billion letters of the human genetic code, which is the biochemical messages that are encoded in our DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, for manufacturing and operating as a complete human being. This is a stepping stone in deciphering the blueprint that makes us human and each of our individual characteristics. Every human cell, be they hair, blood, fingernails, any kind of body tissue, with the exception of our human gametes, which is the ovum and the spermatozoa, have a complete complement of this genetic code that makes us each unique in our own individual way. However, these genetic profiles have information that can be used against us. For example, insurance companies can decide whether to issue life insurance based on genetic makeup with their predisposition for cancer, alcoholism, and other health concerns. At this point, we need to have state laws to go ahead and protect us from some of the discrimination that could happen. Right now, we have state laws to restrict access to our medical records. However, the state of Alaska has yet to specify any protection for our genetic information. Medical information is presumed confidential, but the increasing capability to store and rapidly transfer data escalates with the challenge of, as well as the protecting of privacy. At this present time, there is no national statute regarding genetic privacy laws. Although 15 states have required informed consent for a third party to perform or require a genetic test or to obtain genetic information, 23 states require informed consent to disclose genetic information. Senate Bill 217 to give special consideration to the advancing biotechnology as well as to protect our genetic privacy rights. And I want to make sure that it is clear that the intent of this legislation is not to interfere with law enforcement, medical necessity, as well as paternity determination. As we look at what is presented here in this bill, I have taken the first step in a multi-step action to go ahead and try and make sure that within each individual right, each resident of the state of Alaska has protection for all those genes that they carry around with them that make them the person that they want to be. And we as individuals in the state of Alaska are very protective of our individualism. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm willing to go ahead and entertain questions. If I could continue on, just so you know how complicated this is going to be, is that everybody is fairly familiar with those of us that have taken biology in some way. We've all remembered the cell that's got the nucleus. Inside the nucleus is a bunch of DNA that's made up of whatever else. And having taken molecular biology, we also need to remember, though, that there are also DNA components and a message and a code that's also within the mitochondria, which are actually subparts of the whole cell. So this legislation covers all genetic material, whether it's in the nucleus as DNA, which is deoxyribonucleic acid, which is made from RNA, which is ribonucleic acid. I know we're getting a little technical here, but I want to make sure that there is an all-inclusiveness within this legislation so that I don't see any leaks out there. With that, I will defer to your committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions for Senator Olson?
He was explaining the bill to me the other day.
He was.
And I said, are you a doctor? And he said, well, no, but I did stay in a Holiday Inn last night.
With all due respect, Mr. Chairman, I think some of us are getting more sleep than others. Let me tell you a story.
No, I was going to move the bill.
We have some people like to testify. Oh. I have two folks here from Child Enforcement, Public Safety, who are here to answer questions, and I appreciate that. I have John here to testify. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John George. I'm here representing the American Council of Life Insurers, the ACLI, representing virtually all the life insurance carriers that do business in the state of Alaska. As you heard Senator Olson explain, this bill is aimed largely at insurance companies to prohibit discrimination. And when we think of discrimination, you think of race and sex and national origin and those kind of things. But by definition in the Alaska Insurance Code, AS-21, discrimination is permitted. It can't be unfair discrimination, but it specifically says that, you know, the rates have to be adequate, not excessive, and not unfairly discriminatory. We all recognize in state auto insurance that some people ought to be paying more and some ought to be paying less based on their characteristics. Now, every 16-year-old male driver may not have an accident, but he certainly falls within a class of people that have a higher risk than, say, 35-year-old male drivers. So insurance, by definition, does discriminate. We try and put people in the proper box so we can charge an appropriate rate. In life insurance, there's a different rate for male and female. Now, you say, wait a minute, you can't discriminate based on race, but the fact is that you look at a mortality table, and women and men have different life expectancies. And so using that difference in life expectancy, they pay different rates. You could have one rate, but males who don't live as long would, you know, really can justify a different rate than females. Using genetic information, and then it kind of depends on what genetic information we are using, but even things like, you know, whether your relatives have had heart attacks, high blood pressure, diabetes, whether you have it or not, you know, is certainly an indication of a propensity that you might have, and does put you in a different box than someone whose family history has not had that. So there are very broad definitions of genetic information, and we're concerned that, you know, maybe any medical information might actually be excluded. And you get down to definitions, and see some serious problems with that. We do believe in the confidentiality. Certainly, once you get this type of private information, it shouldn't be something that you spread out willy-nilly. There are insurance regulations, HIPAA regulations that do deal with this, and insurance companies certainly are not out to spread this. But once they do have appropriate underwriting information, they need to keep that information for the life of the policy. We have to be able to justify why we put someone in that particular underwriting class. This bill says once you've used it, you got to get rid of it. Well, so we have some substantial problems with the bill. I have talked to the sponsor, and he's asked me if I could come up with some specific language. I certainly can work with that. But we do have some serious heartburn with this. And in that, the sponsor indicated that insurance underwriting discrimination is a large portion of why this bill was introduced. I think we have some serious talking to do. Today is the first time I've seen this particular committee substitute for the bill, and having not had a chance to see how that corresponds with the previous bill, I guess I can't really talk to it. But just let me go on record saying that the original bill we had some serious problems with. We're certainly willing to work with the sponsor and see if we can come up with some compromise language or not.
What do we have scheduled for next Tuesday's meeting?
Next Monday, we have three other bills. Next Wednesday is wide open.
Okay. Senator Guess?
And my apologies that I had to run out, and so I didn't hear the introduction that the senator gave. When I read this, unless insurance companies are taking actual DNA, I mean, please explain to me kind of how genetic information passed male, female, other things that you can trace to groups and risk groups is being used currently. I guess that kind of threw me off.
Chair, Senator Guest. First of all, in the broad definition of what is genetic information, if we're talking about looking at a specific gene, a propensity for cancer, for instance, that is more specific than information you might find on a questionnaire, has anyone in your family ever had cancer? But it's still genetic information. Any information you get from a blood test, I'm certainly not an expert, and I've come late to the table on this, but they're very concerned that the information that they are getting now, they would not be able to. We don't know what kind of information is going to be readily available in the future. I think as the Senator described, they've made vast progress in unwinding the helix, and I guess we come down to a fundamental question of, should people pay a rate for their insurance based on what the real characteristics are, or should everybody pay the same rate, or should we only have three classes or 12 classes? If we're really talking about protecting the information, that's already being done largely. The Division of Insurance has regulations that do that. If we're talking about future uses, who knows what that's going to be. But they are concerned that information they're gaining now, that the consent form would be unique to Alaska, and so that would create an additional administrative burden because they deal in all 50 states, and they do have a form now that HHS comes up with that they're using. They'd have to have a separate form. Failing to do that, if they had an error, then there's fairly substantial penalties, and there's just lots of things that just don't quite work here. So,
and I appreciate that. If I may just follow up, I guess, my apologies for not being clear. Can you just give me a specific of information that the insurance industry uses now that they don't believe they could use in the future under this bill?
Off the top of my head, and not being an insurance underwriter, I can't. But I would certainly be happy to ask that of the companies and get back to you with that.
I think
it is a concern of theirs. I just can't tell you what specifically.
Thank you, John. I assume that part of what we're talking about here is, somebody wants to come and buy insurance from you, you say, fine, we want to ask you these questions, and we want you some informed consent. With informed consent here, give us some kind of a sample, and we're going to do DNA testing on it. So there you've got a willing buyer, willing to agree and to your investigation. I suspect what good senator is worried about here is that there soon develops a master data bank out there, and just like you might be able to go and check my credit or my arrest record, all of which is statute of limitations is up on, but you can go get that. And I suspect the senator is looking to the day when there will be a huge data bank out there of the DNA material that we may not have had any voluntary act that we did that got ourselves into it. I'm fingerprinted by a half a dozen people, and my arrest record is I had a voluntary component in that one. But here's something that's involuntary, becomes a database, which there was no consent. And I suspect that's what we're concerned about here. Senator Guest.
Thank you, and that's one of my concerns. It also is the when does the point become that it's not a voluntary act because you can't buy insurance without a DNA test? And then it goes further to then is my health and the status of my health and my future health my responsibility, or is it someone else's? I mean, do I have control over what information I receive? So that's
receive and give.
Receive and give, and it's becoming ongoing ethical decisions for us.
Any other questions for John? All right, thank you, sir. Both John and Chris, you're here. Would you come up?
They're online.
John, can you hear us, Maloney?
Mr. Chairman, it's John Maloney. Yes, sir.
All right. Would you? I assume that DNA is being used for establishing. This gentleman is with Child Enforcement. Child Support Enforcement, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, so I assume that DNA is used to prove and disprove paternity?
Mr. Chairman, this is John Maloney, that is correct, sir.
All right, and do you see anything in this bill that will inhibit you all's present use of DNA?
The way the substitute's written, no, sir, it appears to protect our rights to establish paternity.
Or disprove, yeah, establish paternity. All right. Thank you. And Chris, Can you hear us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Chris Boeheim with the Crime Laboratory in Anchorage.
Yes, sir. Do you see anything in this bill that will inhibit investigations of crimes?
No, I do not. It appears to exempt public safety from the use of DNA in criminal investigations.
Okay.
Say that again. What do you say?
He said
it exempts law enforcement in criminal investigations.
So they can collect.
Yes.
Thank you.
Collect, store, utilize, disseminate. All right. Thank you. Thank you both for standing by. All right. Is there anyone else here that wants to testify? Jennifer, you want to weigh in on this one?
I'm observing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will weigh in at a later date.
You in judiciary?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. This is my friend Jennifer Redinger from Alaska Civil Liberties Union. We've spent wonderful moments together over the last 6 or 7 years. All right. Is this bill going to judiciary next, or has been there?
It is, and it should.
Pardon?
It is.
Yeah. Well, I'm torn between holding the bill for a week and giving you and the insurance agencies or companies a chance to weigh in with any suggestions and moving it on to judiciary to deal with this.
Similar to Representative Seaton, if the sponsor is willing to work with the insurance industry to try to get better language, then why don't we allow it, and they can bring up the sponsor substitute in the judiciary.
Sure, I suspect they'll scrub this up pretty good, so that would just be one more thing for them to work on. I don't have any problem. Sure, Senator Seaton could add this to the list.
Senator Green?
I'll have to get the report back here, but I'm not going to hold it up.
Chair, will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move CS for Senate Bill 217 out of committee with individual recommendations and I attach fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, the bill is moved. There's one more item to bring before the committee. We have, for committee members, a group that works with folks who have lost their driver's license because of alcohol and substance abuses and have done their sentence and are under court supervision, and they would like a provision in our law for them to get a provisional driver's license back to go to work. And so we've been asked, pardon?
I was making a comment that I probably shouldn't have.
Smart remark?
No, it's actually nice.
Yeah, so we've been asked if we would consider sponsoring it as a committee bill. So I will get you a copy. We'll hand you out copies, and I'd like you to think about it and consider it. And the next time we are in session, we'll have a discussion about whether or not we would put this forward as a committee bill. Senator Wilkin.
I just want to let the committee know, and you and Jason know, that Marty Meyer is here today. She's going to handle the HESS committee, all the issues that aren't education. So just so you know, the education stuff will still go through Sheila, and anything else Marty is going to take care of. Thank you.
Welcome. Anything else for the good of the order? We're adjourned. Thank you.